Welcome back to the show. My name is Blackstone Joe, and today I'm joined by Brandon.
Hey, how's it going?
So, Brandon, you've done a little bit of everything around here. Why don't you walk us through your experience at Blackstone and what you're doing right now?
Alrighty, yeah. As you've mentioned, I've been a jack of all trades. Almost every job here, aside from Eric, but that's a job that can't really be explained too well. I started as a writer slash an analyst for almost exactly a year. Then I did some data entry, sample check-in, and then there was a opening in the lab, and I was able to jump right in there and took off running. Absolutely loved it.
It was actually during some lab work, actually filter analysis, where we were talking about your Mustang. So we were looking at filters, and I think you mentioned taking a look at your own Mustang's filter as well as the oil. You had some sort of issues you were working through, right?
Yeah. So the initial indication of an issue with the Mustang was a ticking sound, though I wanted to dismiss that as just the typical Ford modular V8 lifter tick. But I noticed that there was a lot of aluminum, iron, and lead in the oil. And then when we started getting the filter analysis going, mine was one of the first handful of filters that Luke and I looked at, and it showed quite a bit of metal.
And so before we get too far, so it's a Mustang GT500, but what's the year and the exact engine type?
So it's a 2007, so the whole name, 2007 Ford Shelby Mustang GT500. It has a 5.4 liter, four valve V8 Mustang. It's supercharged with a 2.1 liter Eaton blower.
That sound you're mentioning with that particular engine type, I think I remember you describing it at one point as like a barbecue grill, like igniting.
But yeah, a tick, 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 tick. There's a video I actually have. One of the last times the engine was running before I pulled it and rebuilt it, of it ticking right by the exhaust because I hadn't uncorked it right past the headers. I originally assumed it was a modular tick, like a lifter tick, but it could have been related, but more than likely it was something else to do with the fact that the pistons were melting down, which is exactly what was happening. The engine was running a little lean.
So before all this started, are we talking about a stock engine here? Were there any modifications? Was there anything else you had to kind of take into account when you were investigating it that might have been related?
Yeah, so bought the car new. It had 52,000 miles, give or take a couple hundred. And the previous owners, there was one that owned it to like 12,000 miles. I believe he left it stock. The guy who owned it for about 40,000 miles before I bought it, all he did was put a cold air intake and a tune. Couldn't find exactly where the tune was from or who did it, but it's so very mild modifications, but modified nonetheless. So when I bought the car, a local shop in Pearson, Indiana, had an open house, a dyno day as they called it, where you could run your car in a dyno, three runs for $75. Ran up there to see what kind of power she was making, and it just threw smoke like a diesel truck running way too rich, rolling coal, I guess, as they would say. And this is a gas engine, so that's very, very, very unheard of. At that time, it was running too rich, throwing too much unburnt fuel out the exhaust. We had it retuned, and it was running much better. However, it was kind of overtuned, i.e., instead of running too rich, it was running way too lean, because we didn't know that the previous or second previous, whichever owner had put a smaller supercharger pulley on, because it was a stock look pulley, just still on there actually, but we didn't know that. So the people who tuned it, to their credit, they also didn't know, and the engine was spinning the supercharger much faster. The supercharger was cramming a lot more air in. It wasn't enough fuel for the from the tune, and that one thing led to another.
So when you checked out the filter, how did, first of all, what did the filter look like when you were analyzing it? What stood out to you immediately, you know, when you had the pleats apart?
So the very first filter, it was as if you were standing in the American Southwest, like I would say 100 miles away from a major city, and looked up at the sky at night, just sparkles, glitter, stars everywhere to be seen. I mean, there wasn't any sort of searching to be done for metal. I mean, you could pick one pleat and find, I don't know, 20, 25 good pieces to analyze. And there was a whole, obviously, filter full of all that.
So you also checked the oil. Were you seeing increases in the spectral results, you know, in parts per million, that looked concerning as well? Or was this a situation where it was mostly excess metal that was visible?
A little bit of both. It's been a while, but if I remember correctly, the report did show an issue, but I had kind of been hopeful and passed that off as just hard use, because the car does get driven pretty hard per request by Carroll Shelby. And that was not the case at all. It was, I believe, trending worse and worse each time, because I would do shorter and shorter intervals between oil changes, and the metals, the actual part per million count wouldn't decrease, so the wear rate would actually increase since I was driving shorter on the oil, and the same or slightly more metals would be found each analysis. So there was definitely signs of a storm brewing.
So with the oil analysis, the filter analysis paired together, what was your next move after you saw all these indicators of trouble along with how the engine was running on your end? What did you do next?
I started to, I guess, really dig deep in the diagnosing, because originally, as we mentioned already here, I thought it was a tick, like a lifter tick, which is mostly negligible. But once I had a hard confirmation that there was metal in the filter, that's never a good thing, and it's only a time bomb once you find that metal. So I started digging a little deeper. I thought maybe it was a clogged cat, because that ticking sound, something could be loose. And part of the diagnosis, I guess I should mention, wouldn't show up in the results, our analysis or oil filter analysis, was that when the car was being driven at moderately higher speeds, to be legal about it, it would fall on its face. It just would not want to go much past a certain speed, and it was underperforming. It was kind of embarrassing, actually, with how poorly it performed. So with that, I thought maybe there was a clogged cat, because I've had that before in, you know, regular road-going passenger four-door cars, and it acted the same. Just the car fell on its face. The engine just did not want to perform. Replaced the cats, and it didn't make a whole lot of difference. So I decided to, I guess the engine kind of forced me into it. This is all coming back to me. So I went out driving around as I usually do. Usually my little rule for driving around is make a right turn if you hit a red light, so you just keep on moving. I got to this traffic jam caused by an unfortunate accident, so I made a right turn and started heading back to where the car is stored. And luckily so, because at one point when I was about half a mile away from the garage where it's stored, I saw someone I recognized. The road was empty, and I whipped around and floored it, and that was enough to break the ring that had been exposed by the melted down piston crown and be smashed repeatedly by number 7 piston up against the head, top number 7. So I was able to pull right back in, and the engine was still running. I was able to back it into the garage, but it was not running very well. You could tell there was something jingling around. It had sounded like someone had some paper clips in a glass jar and was just shaking it in your ear. Again, the car was still running, but it was not good.
So did you feel comfortable doing the rebuild, the necessary repairs yourself? How did you go about the process?
So I guess the first things first, we just tore it down until we found the issue, and it didn't take very long. So when I say we going forward here with the mechanical part of it, my dad is a ASC certified master mechanic, so I had his help. He's a little older, so he didn't do too much of the actual work, but he was definitely a huge, massive help. So I just started tearing it down and got the supercharger off, nothing wrong there, but underneath the supercharger is the intercooler, and as well as the intake manifold, and there were pieces of metal that were, I don't know, probably about, they weren't necessarily like fingernail trimming size, but a little bit bigger. Definitely something wrong. And of course, my dad, being kind of an expert over his whole life being a mechanic, he said, that looks like a ring. Took the head off, and yep, there was a ring. Number 7 was the most obvious because the piston looked kind of like someone had tried to make like 2-grit sandpaper, just super, super rough. And the ring that was left was bent up, and you could see where it was had broken off. So from there, cylinder bores needed to be reboard, and I was going to have them resurface the heads if possible, and luckily they were able to weld them. That was necessary because the part of the head, actually all the heads were melting down atop each cylinder due to the heat because it was running so lean, which makes it so much hotter. And the car never really showed too much indication of overheating or anything. I mean, it runs hot. It's known for heat soak on a racetrack, but it never really got to that point. Yeah, I was able to tear it all down. I already knew an engine shop I wanted to go to. Originally, it was when and if the engine fails and or I have enough money. And, well, it was one of those kind of strong arm into by the engine itself, telling me that it needed to be rebuilt. So L&M Race Engines out in Pennsylvania is the shop that I chose to take the engine to. I tore it all the way down, cleaned it up, took them the bare block, the heads, which were fully disassembled, and then I believe, yeah, all they did was punch the block. They welded the heads for me, and then I had them reassemble the heads with their moderate cams. They're called the NSR, no springs required, so you can use the stock valve springs and also the exhaust and intake springs with them. So they're a little bit more reliable, not super crazy, but still makes decent power and has one heck of a sound. They did all that work. Took a little bit longer than expected, but that is to be expected with something that they don't know if they could save, being the heads. So luckily we were able to get all that back and brought back the bare block. I also had them port the heads and rebuild them, as I mentioned, with their installed NSR cams, new lifters, roller followers, and springs, guides. They weren't trying to upsell me. They suggested that I keep the valves that were already in there because they looked perfect. They cleaned them up quite a bit, refaced them, otherwise brought that all back. And over the course of 2.5 months, every time I had time after work, usually on weekends, I would go over, and again with my dad over my shoulder, I would just put the engine back together per Ford's reconstruction instructions. As he used to work at Ford dealership, and a buddy still was able to get me the Ford like official rebuild stuff, and anything else like the pistons that I bought, they needed specific torque, or they had specific torque specs for them that weren't in the Ford. So, you know, I'd add those into the regular manuals, but otherwise it was as simple as following instructions, really.
Did you have any non-Ford owner friends or family members try to make fun of Ford when they found out your situation? Did anyone give you a hard time?
Oh, I usually beat them to the punch on that one. Every time we look at filters now, usually with Luke, there's a lot of metal. I'll say, oh, this must be from a Mustang. And that's in jest, just because, you know, I love Mustangs, but just from my personal experience, you know, if you can't joke about it. But yeah, no, they couldn't really do it because I beat them to the punch. I joke about it myself. There was not a whole lot to be said, though, because it was tuned and it was not necessarily stock. Otherwise, it probably would have ran for a good long while, and if I didn't push it very hard, it still would have been running. And also, to my credit, or to the engine's credit, rather, it was still running before I tore it out of the car. It didn't completely fail. It was probably getting there, but she was still running.
So what was your break-in procedure after repairs were completed?
So L&M Race Engines, they have actually a lot of good data and articles on their website in terms of what types of oils, what types of fuels. They dive deep into all that, but really their break-in procedure was kind of novel, and it kind of went against logic. And as I understand from looking at the internet, it goes against a lot of people's logic. It was basically, once the engine's done, drop it in, fire it just long enough to make sure the coolant is circulating, shut it off, don't let it idle forever, and then strap it to the dyno and let it rip, tater chip. They wanted you to punch that thing right away because that's the best way to get the rings to seat to the cylinder walls. Otherwise, if you just let it idle forever, you're more than likely going to just glaze over the cylinder walls. You're just going to smooth them out. Michael Rauscher is the guy at L&M Engines. He runs the show, and he described it to me as, you know, the cylinder bores, they're cross-hatched right after they machine them. So the cutter goes in one way and then spins the opposite way when cutting it again. It's like sandpaper. So if you know, just try to go really slow, it'll just smooth it out, like polishing. You have to basically break through that and get those rings seated. Again, that's the number one thing. Everything else off to the side. I mean, the bearings, there's, according to him, there's no reason to think that they're going to wear out unless the installation and the rebuild was done improperly. There's no reason that you're gonna have to worry about the bearings being, you know, hurt with the initially. That being said, you do want to, if you can, make sure your oil gets to where it needs to go. But if you think about it, as long as everything's, again, installed properly, it only takes at most 30 seconds for oil to reach all parts of the engine. And yes, granted, sometimes damage can happen that quickly, but really that pump works so fast at slinging parts, getting oil to parts, that it shouldn't be an issue. Plus, when you install parts, hopefully people are, you know, squeezing a little bit of oil on, you know, the crank journals in between the bearings. So there's already a little bit of oil there. If it's completely dry, there is some instructions that weren't followed. So really, again, the break-in procedure, short answer was just make sure the engine will run and then drive her hard to break, or what, rather seat the rings into the cylinder walls.
So where do things stand now as far as operationally? Is it running as good as ever? I mean, how would you describe it now following the rebuild?
The car's always put a smile on my face. Aside from the times where I'm sitting in traffic and heard that tick beforehand, now it's just every time without fail, there's a smile. Just, it sounds so beautiful. It runs like the wind. It is actually dangerously fast now. It still has a stock blower. I ran on the dyno, a hub dyno, which is a bit more reliable, and I don't usually have a correction factor built in like the Mustang brand, Mustang, not the related to the car, dynos, or the drum dynos, I guess, is the rolling road, as people would call them. It made 610 one of the runs, but the other five runs around it were like give or take 3 horsepower, and that's with the stock blower to the wheels. To the crank, you know, you can do the conversion factor yourself. Some people say 10, some people say 20%. We go with 15. It's over 700 horsepower probably at the crank, but all that matters is what's at the wheels. So yeah, in short, she's running good.
Top speed that you know you've reached?
Allegedly, we'll go with alleged top speed. We'll say that it was a dream, just for the sake of keeping in this alleged conversation. When you're going that fast, you don't look at the speedometer. Just like on race cars, the speedometer is irrelevant. The tachometer is what you want to look at. But even still, if you're going that fast, especially on a road, i.e., let's say a 3-lane divided highway like an interstate where there's nobody on it, at least ahead of you for a good mile and a half or two, you're going to be looking at the road even still. But when you let off the gas and you look down and the speedometer is creeping below 150 and fourth, and you only went up to the top, well, 5,500 RPM in fifth gear, yeah, I'd say probably about 150, 155, but that's just after decelerating. Yeah, that's in fourth gear, 5,500.
Pure speculation here.
And it's a 6-speed, so there's more room to be had, but the tires and aero probably couldn't handle it. At one point, the tires would probably fly apart, or the hood might come unlatched because it only has a single regular latch, like most road-going vehicles. Doesn't have any race like hood pins or anything. So the hood would probably fly off and up into the windshield before the tires would explode, and then drivetrain components would start going.
When you first start coming across, you know, the issues, the symptoms of trouble, less than ideal results, during that period of time, did you let yourself go to the internet, start searching symptoms, reading forums?
I don't usually post or participate on forums. I just like to be like an outside observer, trying to just get as much information as I can, because I find that usually when you start jumping in, people, there's a lot of good information out there, and a lot of people know their stuff, but I feel like a lot of people just like try to throw out their own opinion without any facts, and it's really bothersome. So it's usually easier to find, you know, your own answers without having to just wait for responses. But unfortunately, most of the forums that I found, the most recent responses to questions would be like 2013. And this happened in, what, 2021 is when I finished building the engine. First start was the beginning of March. So 2020, you know, that's a 7-year difference between when people were asking these questions. And now, even though most of these, well, a good number of these GT500s now are heavily modded, so the stock issues probably don't matter a lot to most people, except for like collectors. But in any case, when I was looking at the forums, the main thing I kept getting was lifter tick. I would search, you know, GT500, modular motor, 4-valve, 5.4-liter, supercharged, whatever, search criteria, you know, engine tick, and it would just always, almost always be lifter tick, lifter tick, lifter tick, just like the Triton V8s. Which is common, but so I, you know, that helped me ease my mind. It was kind of a confirmation bias, if you will, because I wanted that to be the case so that when I saw that people were saying it was lifter tick, well, oh, yeah, see, this person says that. So I guess really there wasn't a correct answer to what my noise was. Granted, the information was old, and it kind of goes hand in hand with what we're seeing. If we look through the averages, or really all the data we have for this specific engine, whether it be from a 4GT or a GT500, the 5.4 4-valve, next to none of them had the same metal concentration that mine did, the aluminum, iron, and lead specifically. I'm trying to remember. I think aluminum was usually the highest, and that was one of the things Ryan Stark had always mentioned, that maybe it was the timing tensioners, like the 4.6-liter, was it a 3-valve or 2-valve, whichever. And those were fine when I pulled the engine apart. You know, it's a different engine, but that was a good suggestion, something to look at for sure. That, again, that kind of went hand-in-hand with what we're seeing with our results here. No one really knew specifically. It was, I guess, a rare case, or most people, when they get a GT500, they just, once the engine explodes, they don't bother testing it, and they just rebuild it. At that point, it's too late. So the forums weren't too helpful, but yeah, there were definitely some rabbit holes.
Do you think if you had not tested the filter, if you had not tested the oil ever, and you were going strictly off of symptoms when you were driving the car, how bad could things have gotten?
Well, so I always, I guess, when I heard the tick, in the back of my mind, even though, again, I had confirmation bias that it was lifter tick, even some of my buddies at the Ford dealership, you know, it was probably just lifter tick, turn up your radio kind of thing. At the same time, I kind of knew that sounds like that usually aren't indications of the engine running better. Now, engines, as long as they're running, they're always technically losing life, even if they're running perfectly. But that being said, knowing that there was a lot of metal in the oil filter when we did that analysis, that was a real punch in the gut feeling, where something I knew but didn't want to admit, I had confirmation that it was happening. So when I would drive it around, I would be a little bit more cautious and much more conservative with the use of the gas pedal. And I guess, yeah, that would, it helped me keep an eye on things and drive it, again, more conservatively. And I also kind of got lucky with where the ring started or kind of blew. I mean, the engine was still running, so it could have hobbled it back home. But luckily, all I had to do was pull it into a subdivision where the speed limit's like 25, 30 anyway. And me going 15 miles an hour doesn't raise too many eyebrows back in a subdivision. Although an engine hobbling along, sounding like it's just absolutely struggling, got a little bit of attention from a couple neighbors that knew what was up. But otherwise, yeah, there was definitely some good heads up given by the analysis, oil analysis and filter analysis. But the important part is just to be able to keep in mind and realize that something may be happening instead of ignoring possible issues and signs, you know, even if it's not something you want to hear. Sometimes, you know, bad news can be more helpful than good news.
So you have a lot of love for Mustangs, obviously. This is a tremendous amount of work, time invested. Can you put your finger on where all that came from as far as appreciation for, is it the GT500 in particular? Was that the dream car, or did you get there at some point?
So it became my dream car. Actually, I was just talking about this the other day. I guess evolution of my dream cars are the following. It was originally the Corvette, the C5 Corvette. I had a black model of one that I got, like a 118 scale of it. Took it to show and tell in second grade, and then I had the C3 Stingray. But then it all changed when I saw Gone 60 Seconds. Like most people, they love Eleanor, so I'm like, GT500, gotta have a GT500. And then 2007 came along shortly thereafter, because I saw the movie first in like 2003 or 4, a few years after it came out. And 2007 came along, and I happened to be at a car show in Omaha, Nebraska with my dad where Eleanor was. And just behind it, they had the new, at the time, forthcoming Mustang for 2005 model year, and it kind of stayed in the back of my mind. A couple of years later, they announced the GT500. I'm like, I have to have that. I just have to have it. And that became the dream car. 2013 came around, and I was looking for just a Mustang since I was thought I could afford it. And spoiler alert, I could afford it. Turned out, just had to work through college instead of party. But in any case, went to a Ford dealership down in Greenwood, Indiana, Ray Skillman Performance Ford, and was looking at a Boss 302 initially. But I told the salesman that came out to talk to me that the dream car would be a blue GT500, but it might be hard to come by, and he found the perfect one, cheaper than the Boss 302. It was blue, to say the least, and the rest is, I guess, history.
But, I mean, I have to know, and I think the people deserve to know, where does the Geo rank?
The Geo is always number one. It's the OG. That Geo Metro, it is the, I think it might have been the first brand new car my dad bought in 1991, as he says, brand new out of the box. Of course, he didn't keep the box for the Geo. That would have been actually funny to see. But regardless, it hasn't needed anything besides belts, mufflers, because it seems to blow through those mufflers for some reason, and spark plugs a couple times. Otherwise, it hasn't needed a single thing. Oil changes, you know, are recommended, but don't seem to be necessary on that car for some reason. That thing is, yeah, 5-speed, all of 40 horsepower, probably making about 30 right now.
Is that what you learned how to drive on?
Mm-hmm. Learned how to drive stick. So every time I went to the Ford dealer, or any dealership that had a Mustang, for a while there, I was driving every model year Mustang that was available, starting with a 2005, drove a 7 GTCS, drove a 2006, drove a 2009. I think I might have skipped the 8 model year, but regardless, they're all the same S197 body style. An 11 when the 5.0 first got dropped into the Mustangs. A 15 like 2 days after it hit the dealership down in Ray Skillman. But in any case, each time I went there, it was a manual Mustang because to me, the V6ers are still nice. When I add that asterisk, so I'm not representing an opinion of Blackstone or anything like that. But to me, a true Mustang has a V8 first and foremost, and preferably a manual transmission, just like a Challenger or Camaro. I prefer those with V8s and manuals. But it was that Geo really helped be able to not look like a typical teenager when going to a dealership, because usually, like, I heard it from 5-6 different salesmen. Oh, most young guys don't know how to start the cars, which it always kind of surprised me. I thought they were just trying to, you know, blow smoke up my you-know-what, because they were trying to sell me a car, but they would throw the keys at me and have a grin on their face, thinking I didn't know how to start the car. And I'd always, you know, the first time I went on a test drive, looked over at the guy and said, "You might have to take it for a drive?" Said, "Oh, yeah, you know how to start it, might as well." So
I learned how to drive on a manual, too. And yeah,
absolutely. Nice.
It's the best because, well, also, they're hard to steal, like, for exactly this reason.
Modern theft device, anti-theft device, rather.
So going back to the Mustang, when you got all done with the repairs and the break-in, it sounds like everything was done well. You still had to have, like, the jumping off point again, where you had to trust it, right? Where you had to believe that everything was good to go. Can you talk about that? Was it going to the track one day? Was it letting it rip on the highway? Like, what was your personal okay? It's back.
So when I first got it all set, got dropped in the chassis, made sure every nut and bolt was tight, there was a moment when the car was ready to fire for the first time, and I was sitting there just with my hand on the key, staring off into oblivion, because it was like a Schrodinger's cat situation where if I don't start the car, in my mind, it could be a perfect running engine. Obviously, on the other side of the coin, it could also be an engine that will never run again. But there was like 20 seconds where I was just sitting there staring off into nothing, just not really wanting to start it because I was nervous. A few things make me nervous, but that I just did not want any more issues, especially with the headaches, the literal backache and almost nose break, trying to get the transmission back up into the car without a lift. But cycled the key once I built the courage over 7 seconds, held the key in the start position, and it cranked maybe 7 times. And it fired right up first time, and my dad had it. He told me several times, and still reminds me even now, you know, how amazing that is, because it's very rare that it just starts up the first time. And I've been proud of that, and I still am very, very, very proud of that it was able to start up, didn't have a misfire, didn't, you know, sometimes fuel doesn't make it to the engine, fuel delivery was good, everything just worked seamlessly. And it was, at the time, it was, I just, so relieving. It was one of those about time. It was absolutely amazing.
Have you tested it since repairs?
In terms of oil analysis? Yes. Every oil change now I'm doing, I'm being more diligent about it. I'm just basically watching break-in, washout. I think it's about, just under 2,000 miles total on the engine. Tying back to the break-in procedure, you want to rip it on the dyno. I got like 8 dyno runs in initially within the first 70 miles of the engine's new life. And recommendation was 50 miles, get rid of the, or well, change the oil. And then, I mean, there's different websites, but the one, you know, that all have their different opinions, but the one I wanted to go with was the safest: 50, 250, 500, 2,000, 2,500, and then at 5,000 miles, I can go back to my synthetic 5W50 that Ford recommends. Otherwise, I'm using cheaper oil to help. It was a little bit more abrasive to help, wherein the engine per the race engine shop.
So have you sampled each of those short oil runs?
Yep.
And even when you were extending them gradually, are you still seeing the steady progress even after longer oil runs?
So from the first one to the second one, the metals stayed almost identical on a part per million basis, but the wear rate decreased because there's a longer oil run. And I believe the third oil change, the metals went down slightly and was 4 times long on the oil. So again, wear rate went down. I have about, I think, a couple hundred more miles to go for this next oil change. Not that it has to be exact, but that's one of my little obsessions, is getting oil changes as close to possible as the correct interval. And pulling the oil filter, the only things we found in the oil filter so far, or filters rather, that we've done, the first one, we found some blue and orange specks, which is from, there's paint on the intake and exhaust springs, blue for intake and orange for exhaust. So that is the main thing we found in the first filter, along with some RVT, like some black sealer, which went along with the higher silicon results in the first oil analysis. And the second one, there might have been a little bit more orange and blue paint, but just a couple specks here and there, since there was still some residual oil from the first oil change, of course. Otherwise, nothing major, which has been relieving. I'm still waiting. The car has been driven hard. Every single time I drive it, I keep in the back of my mind it's better for the rings and for the engine to push it. It's how it's supposed to be driven. So every time I drive it, at least once, it sees full throttle. As much as the tires don't like that,
it's wearing well all the while, right?
Yep. So it's not like averages, which it probably won't be ever again, because the pistons are custom. They're Teflon coated ceramic. So ceramic coated Teflon skirted pistons. The rods are stronger. Not that you should ever have metal from the rods in your oil, because otherwise something's majorly wrong and you're probably going to get a knock peekaboo from a rod through the side of the engine before you realize an oil analysis rod's going bad. But in any case, everything's been good so far. Even the oil analysis and filter analysis hasn't shown a whole lot, even considering the hard use that it goes through every single time it drives.
Well, cool. This has all been nice to sort through, because I put out a survey where I asked, our listeners for what kind of content they wanted to hear. And they wanted to hear about using analysis to find issues, kind of sleuthing through things, ownership stories, using analysis to help lead to repairs, using it to get engines back on the road. So when we were looking at filters, talking about your Mustang, it checked all the boxes.
Awesome.